Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. And coming up on the program, Action SA calls for the abolishment of deputy ministers. It's not the first time we've heard this argument. A new report reveals that children are getting digital devices as young as 3 years old, and the green economy is now in desperate need of more experts. Where are we going to find them? It's Tuesday, the 4th of March. South Africa's supersize executive has long been a point of contention, many critics arguing that excessive government spending hinders economic progress. Now the party Action SA is taking a firm stance, proposing legislation to eliminate the role of deputy minister, arguing that the money should be redirected to essential services. My question, is this a practical cost-cutting measure or maybe just a populist move ahead of the election? I'm in conversation now with parliamentary leader of Action SA, Athol Trollope. Athol, a very warm welcome. So you've framed this as a cost-saving measure, but isn't the whole idea of the big cabinet necessary to appeal and to appease all parties in the GNU?
Jeremy, thanks very much. I think your introduction said it all, except for the fact that we've just had an election. So this is the perfect time to deal with this matter. We couldn't have the budget table 2 weeks ago because they couldn't make the numbers balance. So what we have to do is we need to start saving and cutting costs and being exemplary. Now, the big issue was 2% VAT increase, and we're saying cut the fat and leave the VAT as it is. And we have the biggest cabinet in the world. There are many countries with double our population and more with a much bigger GDP, and they have many less cabinet ministers. We have 32 cabinet ministers and 43 deputy ministers. And the Constitution says in Chapter 93 that the president may appoint. Our deputy ministers have no constitutional powers, so we believe that they're completely superfluous and we could save a billion plus rand by getting rid of them and all their perks and all their entourage.
So if you're pushing to remove deputy ministers, why not go the full hog, address the issue of bloated government when it comes to advisors, consultants and other excess spending?
We're doing exactly that in our proposed members' legislation, that we, for example, ministers and deputy ministers have free housing. Why should they have free housing? I live in Cape Town during the week. I pay for my own housing and I pay for my own home at home. Why should ministers who earn a whole lot more have that free benefit?
So the question might be, Athol Trollope, if deputy ministers were to be removed, who would handle their responsibilities? Would it not just shift the workload elsewhere without actual real savings?
You know, Jeremy, this is just one of the saving mechanisms that we're saying, and we believe that it will lead by example to say we are prepared to cut our own cloth at executive level to give an example to the rest of the country.
Politically, though, is this realistic for the government of national unity right now? Back to my initial question, which says that there are so many people inside that tent and that compromise and unanimity needs to be achieved.
Well, surely it can't be about individuals and who gets a position. It shouldn't be about putting the country first. And the cabinet isn't that much bigger after the GNU than it was before. So I really don't see why we need to have a cabinet that size. It's not about accommodating individuals. It should be about putting South Africans first.
How much support do you think you would get for a move like this?
Well, you know, we've got two bills, one about zero corruption and the other cutting the size of the cabinet. And if parties vote against it, they'll either be voting against cutting corruption and against leading by example. So I think they're going to find themselves between a rock and a hard place.
Are there specific ministries where you believe deputy ministers are either completely redundant or maybe add some value, or is this just a blanket proposal?
You know, during the Eastern DRC debacle, we saw that having ministers, deputy ministers, meant very little. We were questioning the Minister of Defence, and with her was a deputy minister of defence who was a general previously. He had nothing to say. He had no authority to speak. He had nothing, no input to make in the debate. So that illustrates why we believe that they're completely superfluous, all of them.
Do you not believe that some portfolios are more important than others? I'm thinking of finance, for instance.
Well, why would you need a deputy minister of finance? We've got two deputy ministers of finance, and they couldn't get the budget right. And also, both of them have traveled much more overseas than the minister himself. The minister has spent 2 million rand traveling. They've spent nearly 6 million rand traveling abroad.
So could eliminating deputy ministers possibly create power vacuums that would make ministries less effective and slower in decision-making, given that the decisions are often slow in the first place?
I think they would have the opposite effect. I think they're slow now because there's just too many people. There's too much bureaucracy. It's bloated. The less cabinet ministers and deputy ministers you have, the more agile the government would think. That's the objective, to have an agile, reactive government that can work quickly.
Athol, I absolutely acknowledge that it is an issue, but and it's not the first time, as I mentioned at the start of this conversation, that it has been raised before. But there's also the argument that it maybe is a distraction from real economic imperatives. Again, is this a real priority over bigger policies that would directly impact job creation? You're grabbing the headlines with this, and I acknowledge that, but surely it's a drop in the ocean.
Well, look, I think, you know, every drop adds to the ocean, and leading by example is a very good way to go. The other private members' legislation that we tabled yesterday was zero tolerance of corruption. Now, there's a lot of lip service paid to corruption, but when it comes to actually doing something about it, we don't see anything being done. So we believe that we need to be seen to be doing something. So cutting the cabinet size is a really positive step. Secondly, zero tolerance for corruption, and adding that if you are found guilty of corruption over 500,000, that there'd be a minimum sentence of 15 years, and that there will be blacklisting of companies and individuals and elected public representatives never to be able to serve or to do business with government in the future. Those are kind of really bold initiatives that show that we're serious about the things that hold us back as a nation. And corruption is one of the biggest hurdles that we have, especially impacting the poor people of this country.
Given that it's going to be difficult to get this over the line for all the obvious reasons, and if the proposal fails, is Action SA going to push for deeper public service reforms, or is this just a one-off campaign?
No, most definitely we will be pushing for deeper and more comprehensive administrative reforms, but we need to start with ourselves. We need to start with Parliament and members of Parliament and members of Cabinet. And that's why it's going to be very difficult for these other parties not to support our legislation, because if they don't vote for a zero tolerance of corruption piece of legislation, they would then be endorsing it. So I think they're going to be caught between a rock and a hard place.
Athol Trollope, thank you very much indeed, the parliamentary leader of Action SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Aviation safety is always a critical concern worldwide, and Africa's airline industry continues to face unique challenges despite notable progress. According to the latest report, though, from the International Air Transport Association, we know it better as IATA, Africa recorded 10 accidents last year, marking an increase in the all-accident rate. Yet with the positive news that for the second year in a row, there were no fatalities. However, with the second or with the highest accident rate globally and a high proportion of incidents involving turboprop aircraft, safety does remain a pressing issue for the region. Joining me now is Lyndon Burns, aviation expert, owner of Plane Talking, the agency to unpack these findings, explore the trends, and discuss what's being done to improve aviation safety in Africa. Lyndon, a very warm welcome. So this report highlights an increase in Africa's accident rate. What do you think is driving it? And maybe just give us some context. It's serious, but we are showing an improvement, if I read this correctly.
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, indeed. The bottom line is that air accidents are extremely rare, and we're talking about this in the context of commercial airline operations. We're not talking about, you know, general light aircraft and training flights and things like that. And if we look at it, the global picture is looking fantastic. The safety record has improved dramatically. You know, 5 years ago, we were talking about one accident every 456,000 flights. Now we're talking about one every 810,000 flights. It's not to be celebrated, but there were 244 onboard fatalities last year. But there were 4 billion people who traveled by air last year. And I think those are the significant headline numbers. And in Africa, yes, we did have 10 accidents, no fatalities, thankfully. And a lot of those were to do with runway excursions. So that might have been a problem with either the runway, an aircraft landing in poor conditions, or the runway that's not been kept in good condition. There were a number of accidents that involved landing gear problems as well with the aircraft. So that could speak to things like maintenance or foreign object damage on an aircraft. But there's been a big drive over the last 10 years, a concerted drive by IATA and other bodies like the UN Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to really try and get its arms around the safety situation in Africa. And they've got a lot of collaborative outreach now. The civil aviation authorities like ours here in South Africa are now regularly holding workshops to go and raise the awareness and the need to adopt international benchmarked standards and recommended practices, and not, you know, have everyone doing their own thing, but rather take what's been proven, not reinvent the wheel, just put it in place, hold people accountable, make sure you've got the systems in your operation with the airline or the airport or the air navigation service provider to make sure that, you know, you're doing things in the right way. And basically we're taking a model that was applied in Latin America over the last 10 years and has worked with immense success there. And we're looking at doing that here in Africa, and it seems to be working quite well. Yeah, the accidents that did occur were not accidents with major airlines. They were mostly with sort of secondary regional carriers flying in places like the Sudan and the DR Congo, where there's obviously heightened risk as well.
Lyndon, as far as South Africa is concerned, there have been well-documented incidents of equipment deficiency, particularly at some of the smaller airports. That is worrying, though, and the risk surely is growing in that respect.
The big worry here at the moment is the withdrawal of instrument flight procedures by the Air Traffic Navigation Service Company, which is a state-owned entity. They've withdrawn over 326 procedures countrywide. Now, these procedures are there for safety. They're there as a safety enhancement so that pilots know, how to fly their aircraft, what speed they should be at when they're descending to an airport, what speed, direction, configuration, height above the ground at various points along the path to a runway, and the same when they take off and climb to a cruising altitude. The ATNS failed to maintain the approval of those. They're meant to review each procedure every 5 years, and it turned out in some cases they hadn't been doing it up to 12 years. So there's a massive backlog, and the only way that they could get around that and avoid some sort of sanction was to withdraw these procedures. And that, unfortunately, has had the unintended consequence of raising the safety risk in the country. The airlines are doing absolutely everything they can to avoid it, to mitigate that increased risk. But it has manifested in a large number of delayed flights, diverted flights, cancelled flights. And obviously that really upsets travellers, because then you end up with, you miss meetings, your baggage doesn't get connected onto onward flights.
Lyndon, let me ask you this just in conclusion and very briefly. The report also says that turboprop aircraft have accounted for 40% of accidents involving airlines. You did talk to me about the common accident types being runway excursions. Are these aircraft more vulnerable? And again, what's the usage like in this country?
So they're not necessarily more vulnerable. It's just that they are more prevalent in those kind of regional operations, flying to more remote destinations, and they tend to operate also on routes where you just couldn't economically justify a 100-seater jet, or they're typically aircraft that would carry anything between 30 and 50 or possibly 80 passengers,
right.
But there aren't too many of those around. They do operate. They're quite prevalent across the continent. We do have them in South Africa. They're not unsafe aeroplanes. You know, some of them are quite modern. A turboprop is just a jet engine with the fan on the outside instead of being encased in a nacelle. It's still a jet engine. It's not an old piston propeller engine. It's a turboprop. And they have all modern avionics. But again, it's down to what kind of operations are they flying? Where are they being flown to? What are the conditions like in those places? And the accidents that we've seen have tended to be flights to fairly austere places.
Lyndon Burns, I'm going to leave it there. From Plain Talking, I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there's a new report that disturbingly reveals that South African children are accessing digital devices as young as 3 years old. Many parents, though, are unaware of the risks that are posed by the online world, from cyberbullying to data privacy concerns. So my question today is, what can parents do, what can educators do to strike a balance between digital literacy and safety? We have spoken to Arno Janssen van Vuren, MD of education insurance company FutureWise before, and he joins us again. As young as 3 years old, I mean, this is really concerning. What would a three-year-old be doing online?
Yeah, listen, Jeremy, it's tough. When it's raining in Joburg and there's nowhere to go with the kids, it's very easy to get a tablet out and a phone out. So I understand the plight of parents, but as you say, 3 to 6 years old is a very young age to be exposing kids to digital media.
And Arno, it's disgraceful that a parent would actually resort to that kind of behavior, particularly with a three-year-old. People should be better aware, surely.
So you know what's interesting, and you cited the research from Kaspersky, the cybersecurity company, saying kids get phones between 3 and 6 years old. But that same report actually said that more than a quarter, 26% of parents that actually give their kids these devices, they haven't had any conversation around cybersecurity, safety on the internet. So we're leaving our kids quite exposed. And I mean, if you think about when we grew up, we ran over the street and we went to the park, we played with the kids. But before that happened, your parents always said, look left, look right, look left again. When the lights come on in the street, you got to come home. Like, those basic safety conversations are ingrained in you. And the new digital age, the guys are waking up with phones in their hands. They need to learn these same tricks of the trade.
So it's a complete abrogation in many respects of responsibility. Is there an approach or a strategy even that parents should adopt to ensure children's online safety? And I guess the first one is keep the tablet out of the way of a three-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot to be said for having a lot of activities ready to keep kids busy and to make sure that they stay away from screen time. But if you're going to resort to screen time, and I know it is something that a lot of parents are unfortunately forced to do, I think it's important to have those hygiene sort of factors in place and say, listen, we're going to set a screen time limit. You can find the World Health Organization research around what is appropriate screen time per sort of age of your child. And then monitor the usage. I mean, there's a lot of apps out there nowadays where you can actually set the security settings on your devices to say certain things can't be accessed, certain apps time out after a certain period of time. You want to control those dopamine hits. You want to make sure that your kids aren't just doom scrolling and getting into sort of an algorithm projecting at them and telling them what to think and what to do. So I think that's definitely the first place for parents to start.
And in many respects, shame on the social media and tech companies who probably are not doing enough to protect young users. The quicker you get into the web, the more advantageous it is for them.
Yeah, absolutely. The more money they can make out of users, they'll optimize the experience for that. But when the users are children, more needs to be done to protect them. And that's where the parents can step in and as we said, actually find the security settings, actually go into the app and explore to understand how you can protect your child more. And I think also just like very good basics for your kids to understand if they're engaging with anyone in the digital world, they might not be who they say they are. Like, you don't share personal information. Understanding that that people don't have your best interest at heart. It's tough conversations to have with a child, but it's the right place to have them to make sure that to make sure that they are equipped for this digital age that we live in.
While parents might be abrogating responsibility, I would also suggest that schools and educators need to play more of a role in teaching online safety. And I suspect, and it was a long time ago that my children were at school, but I suspect that this is probably not happening sufficiently.
Yeah, you know what? I feel like if we encourage our kids to be online and to do a lot of learning online and also just keeping them busy online, we need to also protect them from the dangers that happen online. So I think if you take that a bit closer to home, for FutureWise, we sell education insurance, and with that we package a learning hub that gets kids online learning, get their coding and get their sort of additional support in their learning algorithms from a digital source. We decided to partner with the Social Kids program that actually teaches kids to be safe online and that gamifies that for kids from, let's say, age 6 to 11 or around about there, to say, listen, we are expecting you to learn online. We need to also teach you to be safe online. So I think, as you say, getting people online, there is a responsibility on parents, teachers, and I think companies as well.
Given that we are moving or have moved already into an almost complete digital world, is there an ideal age at which children should start engaging? Because there's no question that they have to be there, but at what point is the nexus between responsibility and irresponsibility, I wonder?
Yeah, you know what? I wouldn't say I'm the leading expert in the world. I'm a parent of a two-year-old trying to figure it out myself. The World Health Organization does give guidelines on screen time per age. I think we try and stick to that, or to the minimum level of that, so to introduce it gently. And then I think where it makes sense to actually just apply these rules that we spoke about, mm-hmm. and to let your common sense actually guide you, because we need to teach our kids to use these things, and I think we should see phones and tablets and the internet as tools and not as nannies and not as pacifiers. And if we teach our kids to use these tools, but we also teach them to be responsible human beings while engaging with people and with tech, I think that's a winning formula.
I assume you haven't bought your two-year-old a tablet yet.
We have not, Jeremy, and we'll try and push that out as far as we can.
Going to leave it there. Arno Jansen van Vuren, Managing Director of the education insurance company FutureWise. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The global push for sustainability is accelerating, but South Africa, it seems, is falling behind in developing the critical so-called green skills needed to drive climate resilience, conservation, and sustainable development. From water management to reforestation and renewable energy, demand for environmental expertise is soaring, yet universities, it seems, other training institutions are maybe not keeping pace. So here's my question. Why is all of this important? What are the gaps in green skills education, and what needs to change and change quickly to ensure that we're not left behind in the green economy? Joining me now from Rhodes University is Dr. Matthew Weaver, researcher at the Institute for Water Research. Matthew, a very warm welcome. So maybe let's just get a handle on what green skills are and how they differ from traditional environmental science education and why they're becoming more critical.
Yeah, so green skills relate to conservation-related skills, how we work with nature or to enhance nature or with nature to benefit human and the environment. And we're finding that nature-based solutions in a South African context and an African context are missing, or not quite missing, but need to be enhanced if we are to really get a handle on or better address climate change issues, other conservation and biodiversity loss-related issues that we're facing.
And are there specific industries in this country that are most affected by the shortage of these skills? And there must be huge risks if these gaps remain unfulfilled.
So what we are finding is that the engineering industries are typically staying in their silo and largely continuing to develop against or not necessarily with nature. So development towards sustainable development in Africa is following traditional lines of engineering disciplines. and the environmental scientists, who often are the gatekeepers for sustainable development through environmental impact assessment, are also requiring a bit more development in nature-based solutions or green skills. Particularly the integration between engineering sciences and environmental sciences. So we are finding that integrated skills, the ability to integrate between ecology and engineering design and conservation and engineering design towards more sustainable projects and development is falling behind. I think we rely traditionally on our silos of engineering and sustainability science, which is a challenge.
So, Matthew, getting this right is a lot more than just a single meeting. How would you suggest that training institutions move towards restructuring their curricula to achieve that kind of integration, which is so sorely needed?
I think we need to start small, at least starting to integrate some courses and some capacity development processes either within existing engineering curricula or include additional nature-based solutions or green skills-related courses within them. The challenge is that engineering degrees, as they are jam-packed. So motivating for the inclusion of some of these more integrative degrees and learning content is going to be difficult. So what we are doing is we are working with a couple of universities in South Africa, Rhodes University, UCT, and also in Senegal, to actually accredit and include some nature-based solutions related courses related to water, engineering and building with nature, ethics and engineering into existing courses. So I think that's one start. You can also start before you get to university, so foundational and high school education. There's scope to include some content there as well.
Your argument, I think, is probably predicated as well on student interest in sustainability-focused careers. Is that actually a thing?
Is it a thing? I would hope so, Jeremy. I think as people face the reality of climate change effects, so, you know, droughts and water shortage and massive fires affecting cities, our rivers becoming more and more degraded. I think you can't not be interested. You can't not experience the hardship of where we are failing nature and where nature is kind of pushing back. So optimistically, I think there's a greater interest, but I probably need a greater reality check to see whether we are seeing more graduates taking up these kinds of or sustainability science, these green related degrees.
And
courses.
Matthew, it's always easy to bring government into a conversation like this, but is there any degree of disconnect between government policy on sustainability on the one hand and actual interest and investment in green education and growing the workforce in that respect?
There's signs of the gap being closed. So we've got policies and efforts through SANBI, the South African National Biodiversity Institute, promoting restoration-related projects, investment. There's a big emphasis on strengthening and preserving our key ecological infrastructure areas, specifically at our headwaters of our catchments. The Water Research Commission has recently put out calls to, or at least one call, that focuses on exploring nature-based solutions for water resilience, water catchment conservation. So, and I think also we focus a lot on ecosystem-based adaptation, which is, in my eyes, quite similar to nature-based solutions. So you're seeing the words coming through, Jeremy, in some of the policies, but I think we've got a way to go to kind of get on the same page, you know, business, academia, local public, and invest, and part of that involves learning each other's languages, which takes time.
Sure.
Essentially, and being able to communicate across these disciplines, I think, is an important step towards progress.
Let me just ask you one final one. I fully acknowledge your suggestion that starting small is better than not starting at all. But unless we close this current skills gap quickly, surely we are going to fail in meeting any climate commitments that we've made and very onerous sustainability targets.
Yes, no, completely. And I suppose the worry is that with our approach is we are starting to integrate skills development in and training into universities, and the bureaucratic process to get new degrees accredited has got a lag phase of three years or more. So it is going to be slow. So what we've also realized is that there are quicker approaches. So we, as well as developing longer courses, we're developing short courses. So a professional that's already working in the industry, already has work aligned to sustainable development, could take plug a skills gap with a 1 week short course across various different elements of the nature-based solutions or sustainable development ambit. So that's one approach, but you're right. I think we're going to get a wake-up call. We're likely going to fall behind, but you know, we have to start. We have to carry on.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Dr. Matthew Weaver, researcher at the Institute for Water Research at Rhodes University, thank you very much indeed. And that's also MoneyWeb at midday for today. Join me again tomorrow. The show is live weekdays at noon, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.